content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. Hello, everybody. This is Evan Mercer for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will read to you from the New Yorker magazine. Today, I will read an article from the October 20th, 2025 issue of the New Yorker, What Zohran Mamdani Knows About Power. The 33-year-old socialist is rewriting the rules of New York politics. Can he transform the city as mayor? By Eric Lach. Zohran Mamdani is 33 years old, young enough that, despite not regularly working out, he has run the New York City Marathon twice in the past 3 years. In 2022, his second year in the New York State Assembly, he ran wearing a t-shirt that read, Eric Adams Raised My Rent, and finished in 6 hours and 4 minutes. Few spectators paid him any mind. Last year, less than a month after launching his campaign for mayor, he trotted through the city at a 12-minute, 54-second per mile pace, wearing the same t-shirt with Zohran Will Freeze It added to the back. Again, he caught barely anyone's attention. This year, Marathon Sunday falls 2 days before the New York election for mayor. Polls have Mamdani 15 points ahead of his nearest competitor, the former governor Andrew Cuomo. Mamdani's aides say that he's not running the course this time, though it wouldn't be out of character. His instinct is to be on the move, out in the city, where people can see him. To walk through New York with Mamdani this spring and summer has been to watch a star being born, a process that is as spectacular and gaseous on earth as it is in heaven. On the morning of the primary in June, Mamdani crisscrossed the city as fast as his new security detail could drive him. Giddy commuters on a subway platform in Jackson Heights missed their trains just to show him their I voted stickers. Above ground, he dispatched an aide to a nearby Indian restaurant to pick him up a pan, a betel leaf wrap, which he chewed daintily, careful not to spill any of the filling on the dark suit and tie that he has adopted as his political uniform. In Inwood, even a pair of volunteers for Cuomo sheepishly stopped him for selfies. At a moment when the country is consumed with nativist fervor and New York appears a nest of cynical cronyism, 8 months ago, Mayor Eric Adams agreed to go along with President Donald Trump's mass deportation program to save himself from corruption charges. Mamdani is running a campaign that embraces the city as a beacon for immigrants like him. His win in the primary was a shock to the political establishment, and the powerful began to slink in his direction. Barack Obama gave him a call the next day. After a chilly summer courtship, Governor Kathy Hochul, a hyper-cautious moderate, warmly endorsed him. The Reverend Al Sharpton, who has not endorsed Mamdani or any other candidate, recently told me, "He has had the best entry into citywide politics of any candidate I have seen, probably in my life." In certain ideological precincts, Mamdani's name has become totemic, shorthand for everything wrong with New York, which itself is shorthand for everything wrong with America. Trump has called him a 100% communist lunatic on Truth Social. Jeff Blau, the CEO of the real estate giant Related Companies, and his wife, the investor Lisa Blau, recently called for an emergency breakfast meeting of the wealthy. If we fail to mobilize, the financial capital of the world risks being handed over to a socialist this November, the invitation read. A real estate lobbyist told me that he does not know anyone who is leaving the city because of Mamdani. Senator Chuck Schumer and Representative Hakeem Jeffries have held off on endorsing Mamdani, reportedly in part because of his criticism of Israel. Meanwhile, much of the rest of the city's political class is jostling for position around him. Catherine Wild, the longtime head of the Partnership for New York City, a lobby group representing the city's business leaders, brokered meetings this summer between Mamdani and her members. Many remained skeptical, but some left with a strange new respect for the kid. After I did the meetings with, say, 300 executives, somebody asked me, "How would you rate their reactions on a scale of 1 to 10? Wild told me. I said 1 to 10. Patrick Gaspard, an Obama administration official and the former president of the Center for American Progress, has been quietly advising Mamdani since last fall. He describes Mamdani as a prototype for a new generation of American politicians, forged in the Palestinian rights movement. He's the first to arrive on the shore, but just over the horizon, you can see more ships coming in, Gaspard said. In person, Mamdani is as self-possessed and quick to a punchline as he is in his campaign videos, which regularly go viral. He is also tactical and shrewd, careful with his words. From Bernie Sanders, whose 2016 presidential race inspired him to embrace socialist politics, Mamdani has learned how to pivot relentlessly back to his economic agenda, and it's rare for him to speak for more than a few minutes without returning to his pledges to freeze the rent in the city's rent-stabilized apartments, make buses free and faster, and provide universal care for kids starting at 6 weeks of age. But unlike Sanders, who loathes talking about himself, Zohran doesn't need any political advice from me, the senator told me in September. Mamdani has found power in telling his story. I first met Mamdani in person for the first time in late March at Quawa House, a Yemeni coffee shop in Morningside Heights. It was the morning after the end of Ramadan, and polling in the primary showed him in the teens, in second place, but well behind Cuomo. He ordered a pot of Adeni chai for us to share, and if the guy behind the register clocked him, he didn't show it in his face. The previous day, Mamdani had been in Bay Ridge, Kensington, and Jamaica, home to large Muslim communities in Brooklyn and Queens, for Eid prayers addressing some 25,000 people. He expressed polite incredulity at the press's lack of interest in those numbers. "That's where I feel a sense of confidence," he told me. Mamdani has a solicitous, animated way of speaking that converges on TED Talk. He gestures prolifically, displaying the thick silver rings he wears, and likes to pull quotations from Nelson Mandela, FDR, Toni Morrison, Aristotle. Sipping his chai, he spoke with precision, not just about what he'd do as mayor, but about the voters who were going to help him win. Muslims and South Asians, renters, young people, Democrats who oppose Israel's war in Gaza. When prodded about the inevitable backlash to his more expensive proposals, Mamdani shrugged. "I'm not afraid of my own ideas," he said. When I mentioned the difficulty of what he hoped to pull off, he smiled. "I think for far too long we've tried not to lose, as opposed to figuring out how to win." About a month after Mamdani won the primary, he woke up at 3 a.m. in Kampala, Uganda, to an urgent call from Morris Katz, one of his closest aides. It was evening in New York, and there had been a mass shooting in an office building on Park Avenue. Mamdani was in Uganda to belatedly celebrate his wedding, a trip that would give him and his wife, Rama Duwaji, a chance to say goodbye to private life. The couple had eloped at the city clerk's office in February. Four victims and the shooter were dead. Early, sketchily sourced posts on social media suggested that someone had yelled "Free Palestine" in the vicinity of the violence. One of the victims was an off-duty NYPD officer. The shooting was already being described as a leadership test for Mamdani. Private life was over. New Yorkers can be unforgiving when a mayor is caught out of town at the wrong time. In 2011, Michael Bloomberg was nearly done in when he was rumored to be in Bermuda during a New York snowstorm. Mamdani got on the next flight out of Entebbe, but the trip took 22 hours. While he was in the air, his opponents pounced. Cuomo, who is now running as an independent, started calling reporters to slam Mamdani's views on policing. The Times, which in both its news and opinion coverage has been overtly skeptical of Mamdani's fitness to be mayor, speculated that the shooting may lead some to further scrutinize him. Laura Loomer, the Trump ally and far-right troll, suggested that the State Department ban Mamdani from re-entering the country, a scenario that his aides took seriously enough to run by lawyers. But when Mamdani arrived at JFK at 7 a.m., he breezed through customs. The NYPD had confirmed that the Park Avenue shooter wasn't motivated by pro-Palestinian sentiment. He was a casino worker from Las Vegas who had sustained brain injuries while playing football in high school, and his target had been the NFL's headquarters in the same building. From the airport, Mamdani was whisked into a waiting SUV and driven straight to the home of the deceased NYPD officer, Didarul Islam, a Bangladeshi Muslim immigrant who'd been working a side gig as a security guard at the office building to help pay his family's mortgage. Islam was the kind of New Yorker who Mamdani had recognized was often overlooked in the city's politics. At Islam's home in the Bronx, Mamdani was received by the officer's parents, his pregnant widow, his children, and other grieving relatives. He wept with them for a few minutes. Then, with Bangladeshi hospitality, the family served the candidate breakfast. The legacy of every New York mayor in recent history has been shaped by the NYPD. Bloomberg's accomplishments running the city will always be stacked against his support of stop and frisk policing. Bill de Blasio, who was in office during the early days of Black Lives Matter, never forgot watching hundreds of officers turn their backs on him at the funerals of two cops who were killed on the job. Eric Adams, who started his career as a transit cop, was undone in part by his dealings with corrupt old friends from the department. During the campaign, Mamdani abandoned the language of defund the police. He recently pledged to work with the NYPD if elected. He told me that he now believes policing is a public good and that it is a critical part of how we deliver public safety. But he has struggled to explain why he changed his mind about defunding the police, apart from the fact that he is running for mayor. One of Mamdani's more poetic campaign motifs is public excellence, the idea that socialists need not compromise on quality of life concerns. In the past few months, Mamdani has attempted to reframe his suspicion of police as a human resources issue, an obstacle to excellence. Rank-and-file cops are regularly asked to handle distressing situations outside their skill set, such as dealing with the homeless and the mentally ill. He hopes to take those tasks off their hands by creating a Department of Community Safety, though, by his own admission, some of the details are still to be determined. At the prompting of a New York Times interviewer in September, Mamdani half apologized for his old tweets about the NYPD, but he rejects the notion that his views have evolved. The principles remain the same, he told me. There are also lessons that you learn along the way. No small number of Mamdani's detractors wonder if someone of his age and experience will be capable of running the biggest city in the country. New York has a $116 billion budget, 300,000 employees, and a police department larger than the Belgian army. For more than a century, people have wondered if the city is ungovernable. With the exception of Fiorello LaGuardia, who had New Deal money raining down on him, every idealistic leader who has been elected mayor has left City Hall in some way battered by it. The good mayor turns out to be weak or foolish or not so good, or the people become disgusted, the muckraker Lincoln Steffens wrote in 1903. A City Hall veteran recently told me, "You're constantly making bad decisions that you know are bad decisions. You're presented with two bad options, and you've got to pick one, and that's your day." If Mamdani is elected, the NYPD may well continue to sweep up homeless encampments and forcibly remove protesters who block bridges or roads. He hasn't yet ruled these things out. His administration will not seek to criminalize peaceful protest or poverty, a Mamdani aide said. At a recent forum on public safety sponsored by the policy journal Vital City, he was asked about police involuntarily detaining the mentally ill. "It is a last resort," Mamdani said. "It is something that, if nothing else can work, then it's there." Mamdani was born in Kampala, Uganda, in 1991. This was the same year that his mother, the filmmaker Mira Nair, released Mississippi Masala, about a romance between a spunky Indian Ugandan exile, Sarita Chowdhury, and a straight-laced black carpet cleaner, Denzel Washington, in small-town Mississippi. While scouting for a location to set the scenes of her protagonist's childhood in Uganda, Nair found an airy hill-type property in Kampala overlooking Lake Victoria. The home appeared in the movie, and Nair and her husband, Mahmoud Mamdani, bought it. Zohran spent his first 5 years there, playing in the lush gardens under jacaranda trees. In a profile of Nair from 2002, John Lehrer wrote that the director's talkative doe-eyed son was known by dozens of coinages, including Z, Zoru, Fadus, and Nonstop Mamdani. Mamdani's staff today still call him Z, though recently some have started winkingly to address him as Sir. Nair met Mahmoud while she was researching Mississippi Masala. The daughter of a stern, high-ranking Indian state official, she studied at Harvard, and by her 30s had garnered attention for films that examined life on the margins of Indian society, among cabaret dancers, street children, visiting immigrants. Mahmoud was born in Bombay in 1946 and grew up in Uganda, part of the Indian diaspora that emerged in East Africa during the British colonial period. In 1962, the year Uganda became independent, Mahmoud was awarded one of the 23 scholarships to study in America, which were offered to the new country's brightest students. Barack Obama's father had come to study in the U.S. 3 years earlier under a similar program for Kenyan students. He returned home after his studies abroad and, like the protagonist Nair, later imagined for Mississippi Masala, was exiled in Idi Amin's 1972 expulsion of some 60,000 Asians from the country. The event became a focus of Mahmoud's writing on the pains of decolonization. For Nair, it became the backdrop for a love story. "He's some kind of lefty," Nair told her collaborator, Suni Tarapoto Rivella, the day they planned to meet Mahmoud for an interview. In 1996, Mahmoud published his breakthrough work, Citizen and Subject, Contemporary Africa and the Legacy of Late Colonialism, which described the persistence of colonial structures in independent African nations. He dedicated it to Nair and to Zohran, who, he wrote, daily takes us on the trail that is his discovery of life. 3 years after the book was published, Columbia offered Mahmoud a tenured professorship. The family moved to New York into a faculty apartment in Morningside Heights, where they often had Edward and Miriam Saeed and Rashid and Mona Khalidi over for dinner. For Zohran, they were uncles and aunties, Mahmoud told me in an email. On a Saturday morning this summer, I met Mamdani outside the Bronx High School of Science, his alma mater, to walk around with one of his favorite old teachers, Mark Kagan, who happens to be the brother of Elena Kagan, the Supreme Court Justice. Kagan, the author of Take Back the Power, a first-hand account of his years as a radical organizer in the city's transit union, taught social studies at Bronx Science for 10 years. He inspired fervent admiration in his students, some of whom, Mamdani included, called themselves Kaganites. In his classes, Kagan talked about how race, gender, and class had shaped world events. "We got away from the great man theory of history," Kagan, a bespectacled, gray-bearded guy in his late 60s, said as we crossed the school's sunken courtyard. Mamdani caught my eye and mugged. "There's just one," he said, nodding toward Kagan. Mamdani sat down on some steps and looked up at Kagan, relieved to slip into a comfortable old dynamic. Kagan recounted a parent-teacher conference with Mahmoud during Zohran's freshman year. "I didn't know who your father was. I just figured him as one of these striving parents," he said. "He was grumping about your grade." Mamdani tensed up. "He wasn't grumping like, 'Why aren't you giving my son a better grade?' It was more like, 'Zohran should be able to do better.' And I said, 'Never mind the grade, because the wheels are spinning in your son's head.' And he just floated out of the room." Mamdani credits Kagan with showing him how to command an audience. He remembered the start of class one day during the spring of his senior year, when moods were light and attentions were drifting. Everybody's talking, having a great time, and then you just hear the sound of this machete hit a desk. Kagan had chopped a stalk of sugarcane in half, and he says, "Sugarcane was one of the most valuable crops in the New World," Mamdani said. Kagan handed out slices of the sugarcane so that his students could touch and taste it. The World of Bronx Science, a selective public school of some 3,000 students, many of them the children of working-class immigrants, differed dramatically from the affluent intellectual milieu of Mamdani's childhood. He remembers seeing students of color rehearsing in a jazz combo during his tour of the school. "It was almost a level of parody how aware we were of race," Mamdani told me. "There would be like ultimate frisbee games where the two teams were immigration nation and white nation. With no malice. Simply, these were the two teams." On a 2016 episode of the podcast Encompassed, An Oral History of Bronx Science, a 24-year-old Mamdani joked about a teacher who had chased him down the hall for stealing hall pass forms. "Keep in mind, this guy is a graduate of the Israeli Defense Forces," he said. "He's tailed brown guys for a long time." For college, Mamdani went to Bowdoin, a bucolic liberal arts school in Brunswick, Maine. Columbia, where his father taught, rejected him. Though Bowdoin was whiter and preppier than Bronx Science, Mamdani found his way. The writer Erica Berry, a close friend from college, said, "Walking through the dining hall with him would take longer than with other people because he'd be stopping at random tables, giving high fives." Mamdani majored in Africana Studies and wrote his thesis on the post-colonial theorist Frantz Fanon and the Enlightenment philosopher Jean-Jacques Rousseau. Berry remembers him holding court in the dining hall about Israel and Palestine, an unusual sight at Bowdoin, a fairly apolitical school. Matthew Miles Goodrich, who was a year behind Mamdani and who became a founding member of the Sunrise Movement, told me, "We had a professor who liked to say that Bowdoin was a hotbed of social rest." As a junior, Mamdani co-founded a chapter of Students for Justice in Palestine, which only a handful of his classmates joined. The following year, he exchanged public statements with Bowdoin's president, Barry Mills, over Mills' rejection of a call to boycott Israeli academic institutions. Mills characterized the demand as an infringement on academic freedom. Mamdani and a co-writer countered that Mills was ignoring how the boycott was instead served as a catalyst for greater discussion of Israel's human rights abuses. The occupation of Palestine was a formative moral and political issue for Mamdani. He says that his views were shaped by 2 years that his family spent in South Africa before moving to New York. Hearing the words of Mandela before the interconnectedness of the struggle for freedom with the struggle for Palestinian human rights, and then coming here and seeing the very different way in which that same conversation was being had, Mamdani told me, there was a glaring exception to the supposedly universal beliefs when it came to applying them to Palestinians. In an email, Mahmoud recalled discussions with his colleagues in Cape Town about whether particular strategies for combating apartheid, such as the global boycott of apartheid South Africa, were relevant for the struggle to decolonize or de-Zionize Israel. He added, "Zohran was a listener. I doubt that he remained unaffected by the exchange on these issues." 2 weeks before the primary, Mamdani was invited to appear on The Late Show with Stephen Colbert, alongside Brad Lander, the New York City comptroller who was polling third in the race. Taking advantage of the city's ranked choice primary voting system, Mamdani and Lander had recently cross-endorsed each other as part of an anti-Cuomo strategy pushed by the Working Families Party and other progressive groups. The pair's appearance wouldn't come with an endorsement from the host, but it would air the night before the election. Cuomo was counting on a high turnout in wealthy Colbert-watching neighborhoods. A few days before the taping, Colbert's producers held a prep call with the candidates and their aides. The sample questions covered basic political topics, such as the meaning of democratic socialism. Right before the candidates went on stage, the producers appeared in the green room and said that they wanted to go over a few more questions. Earlier that day, a group of prominent Jewish figures, including Elisha Wiesel, the son of Eli Wiesel, had sent a letter to Colbert demanding that he grill Mamdani on his views of Israel. According to people who were in the room, one of the producers suggested a thumbs up or thumbs down segment. Thumbs up or thumbs down Hamas. Thumbs up or thumbs down a Palestinian state. Mamdani's face dropped. "I just couldn't believe what was happening," he told me. that a genocide could be distilled into a late-night game? His aides were incensed. You have the first Muslim candidate for mayor in the history of New York, Zahra Rahim, a senior advisor to Mamdani, told one of the producers. You don't want to ask him a question about that. CBS did not respond to a request for comment. In the end, the game didn't happen. But Colbert did ask Mamdani whether he believed that Israel had the right to exist. Yes, like all nations, I believe it has a right to exist, he said. And a responsibility also to uphold international law. Mamdani got this question so many times during the campaign that he came to feel besieged by it. It's Islamophobia, the way it's posed and repeated, a prominent Muslim leader in the city who has talked to Mamdani about this told me. Cuomo, who, as a part of his return to political life last year, joined the legal team defending Benjamin Netanyahu in the International Criminal Court, hoped to make Mamdani's criticisms of Israel the defining issue of the election. It's very simple. Anti-Zionism is anti-Semitism, the former governor declared shortly after entering the race. A pro-Cuomo super PAC mocked up a mailer claiming that Mamdani rejects Jewish rights. It included a photo altered to make his beard look darker and bushier. Throughout the primary, Mamdani was steady in his support of Palestinian rights, though he did hone the language that he used to talk about Israel. Whereas he once made jokes about the Israeli Defense Force, he adopted a more solemn tone this year, emphasizing a sense of shared humanity. He often quotes prominent Israelis, such as the Holocaust historian Amos Goldberg, who has described Israel's destruction of Gaza as a genocide, and the former Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert, who has condemned the war as cruel and criminal. Mamdani tends to focus on Israel's violations of international law, which are the basis of its pledge to arrest Netanyahu, in deference to a warrant issued by the International Criminal Court, if Netanyahu comes to New York. This is arguably his most tough-on-crime policy. He emphasizes that New Yorkers don't have to share his views on foreign policy to think he'd be a good mayor. When asked about how he'll win over Zionist voters, he's partial to a line from Ed Koch. If you agree with me on 9 out of 12 issues, vote for me. If you agree with me on 12 out of 12, see a psychiatrist. One of the few times Mamdani got tripped up was in June when he appeared on the podcast of the right-leaning publication The Bulwark. He declined to denounce the phrase, globalize the Intifada, which many supporters of Israel interpret as an incitement to anti-Jewish violence. It's a word that means struggle, Mamdani said, referring to Intifada, after he won the primary, performing well with Jewish voters, especially those under 40. He said that he would discourage his supporters from using the slogan. Many of Mamdani's detractors believed that his stance on Israel would sink his campaign. But Mamdani and his earliest allies, having watched Joe Biden and Kamala Harris lose support over their refusal to oppose Netanyahu government destruction of Gaza, were confident that his position on the war would be a strength. In February, when Mamdani was still unknown to many voters, Alvaro Lopez, a leader in the New York City chapter of the Democratic Socialist of America, published a memo detailing a campaign strategy for him that relied in part on mainstream Democrats who had been radicalized by Gaza. A big issue with the Palestinian Solidarity Movement was that they were kind of two steps ahead of where the majority of working-class people were at. Lopez, who grew up in Brooklyn and spent 10 years as a natural wine rep before becoming a full-time union organizer, told me, the connection wasn't being made to, like, this is why your eggs are so expensive. That disconnect between calls for social justice and appeals to working-class voters was an issue for Mamdani. His base appeared to be wider, richer, and more educated than the city as a whole. His supporters have been caricatured as striving transplants who can't decide if they're upwardly or downwardly mobile, denizens of what the New York City data journalist Michael Lang has termed the commie corridor in gentrified Brooklyn and Queens. In the primary, Mamdani did best in neighborhoods where the median income is between $50,000 and $150,000. Cuomo won in rich and white neighborhoods, but also in poor and black ones. Conscious of this, Mamdani spent many Sundays this summer in church, courting black congregations around the city. In August, he appeared at the First Baptist Church of Crown Heights in Brooklyn and read an obscure passage from the Book of Lamentations. "Even jackals offer their breasts to nurse their young," he recited, "but my people have become heartless like ostriches in the desert." That drew some all rights and amens, but the skepticism in the room was palpable. "Zohran knows by now that I will be on him," Rashad Raymond Moore, the church's senior pastor, said after Mamdani finished speaking. "As soon as he won, I said, 'Now, are the people who voted for you the same people who are pricing us out?' He's been in that tension." In 2015, Mamdani volunteered for the city council campaign of a Queens lawyer named Ali Najmi, whom he learned about from a Village Voice interview with Heems, a former member of the rap trio Das Racist. Mamdani took a particular liking to canvassing. Climbing a six-story walk-up, getting to that top floor, and having a senior open their door, "You see a glimpse into what it is that they live with every single day," he said. He soon became a paid hand, working on several local campaigns in quick succession. El Yatim's campaign in Bay Ridge, the sturdy middle-class enclave immortalized in Saturday Night Fever as the home of John Travolta's character, would become a template for his own. El Yatim was one of the first local candidates endorsed by the rejuvenated New York City Democratic Socialists of America after a membership boom that followed Bernie Sanders' first run for president. Rather than advocating loudly for radical policies, El Yatim emphasized cost of living issues and argued that the Democratic Party should expand its political tent by engaging the city's Arab, Muslim, and South Asian communities, which together numbered about 1 million people, yet had few representatives in local government. "We need to be part of the decision-making," El Yatim told NBC News. On Election Day, El Yatim lost, placing second in a five-way race with more than 30% of the vote. At that time, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez was still a bartender at a Mexican restaurant near Union Square. El Yatim's showing looked to Mamdani like a breakthrough. The fact that a socialist Arab immigrant who supported the boycott, divestment, sanctions movement could pull 30% in Bay Ridge was enough to make him think that he could run for office himself. "Bernie gave me the language of democratic socialism," Mamdani said. "Kadir El Yatim showed me that all my different politics, they had a place that they could belong." Mamdani lives in a six-story yellow brick apartment building in Astoria, Queens. It's an old-fashioned H-shaped pile built in 1929 with mostly one-bedroom apartments and a communal laundry room. On a Sunday evening in early September, he came to his door wearing a spotless white-collared shirt, a dark tie, and house slippers. "Shoes off," he told me. He found the apartment on Street Easy in 2018. It was advertised as spacious with an eat-in kitchen. In reality, it's tiny, what a broker might creatively call a classic three. After Mamdani moved to Astoria, he took a job as a foreclosure prevention counselor at Chaya, a community development organization that serves South Asian and Indo-Caribbean immigrants. His salary was $47,000. The apartment was rent-stabilized. When Mamdani signed the lease, the rent was $2,000 a month. Now, he and Duwaji, his wife, pay $2,300. Working with Chaya clients who were facing foreclosure, Mamdani got an intimate look at the little insanities of the city's housing crisis. Many of his clients were small landlords, immigrant owners of two-family properties who relied on tenants to stay afloat. He tried to match clients with government programs that might help them, but often there was nothing he could do. "I remember talking to this Pakistani guy who only spoke Urdu," he said. "I asked him, 'Do you know that the lien on your house is about to be sold?' And he said, 'No, I had no idea.'" From the beginning, a centerpiece of Mamdani's campaign has been his proposal to freeze the rents for the city's million or so rent-stabilized units, generally found in buildings of six or more apartments, which were built before 1974. A mayor can do this, in effect, because the mayor appoints all 9 members of the Rent Guidelines Board, which determines how much the owners of these buildings are allowed to raise the rent each year. What Mamdani and some of his allies in the tenants' rights movement appreciated is that the board is not some sleepy arm of the city bureaucracy. It is full of political potential. De Blasio backed rent freezes 3 times in his 8 years as mayor. Under Adams, rent for these apartments has been allowed to increase cumulatively about 12%. The Rent Guidelines Board is sort of like a Swedish social democracy institution. Sierra Weaver, a DSA-aligned tenant organizer who has been advising Mamdani, said, "Organized tenants and organized landlords can come together in front of a city board appointed by the mayor, who is reflective of the general populace." If Mamdani is elected and secures a rent freeze next year, one of his biggest opponents will be an old friend, Kenny Burgess, who was 2 years behind Mamdani at Bronx Science, was elected to the assembly in 2020, and the two sat next to each other in the legislature. Burgess, a Democrat, but not a Democratic Socialists of America member, shocked many in Albany last year when he gave up his seat to become the CEO of the New York Apartment Association, a lobby group that represents the landlords of rent-stabilized buildings. Like Mamdani, Burgess is fluent in the new political language of social media. Earlier this year, when the NYAA contributed $2.5 million to a super PAC backing Cuomo in the primary, he texted Mamdani a GIF of Wesley Snipes weeping while shooting his friend from the movie New Jack City. Mamdani gave it a ha-ha reaction. Old apartment buildings get more expensive to maintain as they age. When rents stay flat, owners can feel squeezed. Mamdani likes to point out that the Rent Guidelines Board's most recent data showed net operating income for landlords of rent-stabilized buildings up 12.1% in a single year. Weaver, the tenant organizer, worries that a freeze will prompt landlords to engage in a capital strike, in which they withhold updates and repairs to their properties. Zohran holds the political cards, but landlords are able to create the narrative that the buildings need more money, she said. It's what keeps me up at night. Mamdani knows that a rent freeze will not solve New York's housing crisis. Rent-stabilized units make up only about a quarter of the city's housing stock. The median rent for an apartment on the open market has topped $3,500. High-end condos in Manhattan can sell for $5,000 a square foot. Some 140,000 New York City school children are homeless. Part of Mamdani's strategy has been to cast the affordability problem as one that affects everyone, even the rich. "This is a crisis that is suffocating many rungs of life," he told me. "It's one crisis that has varying levels of intensity, all deeply felt." Effectively addressing the problem will require the construction of hundreds of thousands of housing units in a city already stuffed with them, and major help from the state government in Albany, which Mamdani isn't guaranteed to get. He's advocated for the city to become more involved in housing construction and development, but he's also flirted with the rhetoric of abundance and expressed an openness to private development. According to the New York Times, Mamdani suggested at a meeting with black executives in July that the rent freeze might not be permanent. He has said time and time again that the policy commitment is for 4 years, an aide told me. When I asked Mamdani what was negotiable and what wasn't, he put up his hands, declining to rule anything out. "I'm not running to punish landlords," he said. "We know it's a broken system." But many people who knew Mamdani before his run for mayor confessed to some astonishment at the success of his campaign. Zohran, I think, surprised himself, Jasmine Gripper, a co-director of the Working Families Party in New York, told me. Several lawmakers who served with Mamdani in Albany have described him as more show pony than workhorse. He only got 3 bills passed, and one had to do with where beer could be sold within the confines of the Museum of the Moving Image in Astoria. Jessica Ramos, a state senator from a nearby district who also ran for mayor this year, has said, "I wish he was a harder worker." Burgess disagreed with that assessment. He got stuff done, he told me. Burgess mentioned the hundreds of millions of dollars in debt relief that Mamdani helped taxi medallion owners win from City Hall in 2021, in part by going on a 15-day hunger strike and a pilot program that made one bus route in every borough free. Find me another new assembly member who got tens of millions of dollars for an individual program, Burgess said. Burgess remembered talking to Mamdani after Adams won the 2020 Democratic mayoral primary. He was like, who are we going to get to run against this guy in 4 years? And I said, why don't you do it? He said, I'm too young. They won't take me seriously. Mamdani was then becoming a prominent figure in the DSA, which had positioned itself against the mainstream Democratic Party. In Albany, Mamdani attended weekly meetings of the Socialist in Office Committee, and he considered himself an ambassador for the organization. For me, there's no point in doing this without the Democratic Socialists of America, he told the leftist magazine Dissent in 2022. Since DSA started winning elections in the late 2010s, it's had to confront the challenge of having allies in power. Last year, national DSA leaders withdrew their endorsement of Ocasio-Cortez because she strayed from the organization's line on Israel. Mamdani has encouraged members to put on the pressure. It's a good thing that the rank and file of the organization has been emboldened to make demands of elected officials, he told Dissent. We cannot count on our electeds going into these spaces coming out the way they were sent in. In the spring of 2023, Mamdani introduced the Not on Our Dime Act, a measure that would prohibit New York nonprofits from sending any money to support illegal settler activity in Gaza and the West Bank. He argued that tens of millions of dollars were passing through local groups to support violations of international law. The leadership came down on it harder than any bill I'd ever seen, a veteran Democratic state senator told me. They said it would never get a floor vote. Dozens of colleagues, including Burgess, signed a letter denouncing Mamdani and his co-sponsors. The bill was only introduced to antagonize pro-Israel New Yorkers and further sow divisions within the Democratic Party, the letter said. Burgess spoke with Mamdani shortly afterward. He said, I'll never pass another bill in this town again, Burgess told me. When I asked Mamdani if he'd thought his career in Albany was over at that point, he shook his head. I've lived through many ends in Albany, he said. A few months later, the Hamas attacks of October 7th and the ruptures they immediately produced in the U.S. gave new shape to Mamdani's politics. On October 13th, he was arrested during a ceasefire demonstration outside Chuck Schumer's apartment in Park Slope. He conferred with other Muslim leaders who were concerned about Islamophobic backlash in the city, and some of them became part of the brain trust of his mayoral campaign. That winter, Mamdani was invited by leaders of the Working Families Party to a series of meetings with other elected officials who were considering challenging Eric Adams in the primary. It's hard to remember now, but this was before Adams was indicted, before Trump got reelected, and before Adams and Trump cut a deal. The WFP was floating the idea of having several candidates run as a collaborative slate to avoid the infighting that they believed helped Adams win in 2021. The other candidates, for the most part, didn't know Mamdani or trust the Democratic Socialists of America. The movement against the war is growing. Zohran is at the center of it, and we thought, he needs to be at the table, Ana Maria Archila, the WFP's other New York co-director, recalled. I can't tell you how much resistance there was to his presence. Meanwhile, some DSA-affiliated officials worried that Mamdani would look like a spoiler and hurt the organization's standing with progressive Democrats. This is unfair to our project as a whole and could be ruinous, Emily Gallagher, an assembly member from Brooklyn, wrote to members of the New York chapter ahead of a vote on endorsing him. Mamdani's campaign began in earnest last fall after Trump won his second term. Many people's first encounter with him was a video he posted in November in which he interviewed black and brown New Yorkers in working-class neighborhoods about why Trump had done better with their cohort and why some of them hadn't voted at all in 2024. Some talked about food prices and the cost of living. Others talked about being demoralized by war. I like the Democrats, but I don't like this in Gaza. A lot of people are dying, a bearded older man said. At a moment when Democrats appeared clueless about social media and out of touch with working class people, Mamdani came across as curious and undaunted. So began a campaign that fused blunt political messaging with big-hearted moving images, a sensibility not unlike that of Nair's films. In a video promoting the rent freeze, Mamdani plunged into the frigid waters of Coney Island on New Year's Day and emerged with his suit and tie sopping. He made late-night visits to halal vendors to discuss the rising costs of chicken and rice. In all his videos, an affectionate and softly romantic vision of the city came through. In May, the WFP ranked Mamdani at the top of its slate of endorsements, and though his competitors kept waiting for him to slip, he only kept up his run of deft politicking. The week before the primary, one of Mamdani's aides, Julian Gerson, suggested that he walk the length of Manhattan, meeting voters along the way. The rest of the campaign staff thought it was impractical, but Mamdani was taken with it. That Friday night, at dusk, Mamdani set out from Inwood. The resulting video of a young candidate striding through the city into the early morning hours, getting cheers everywhere he went, convinced more than a few holdouts that something was happening. One of Mamdani's early memories of New York is from after 9/11, when a teacher pulled him aside and said to tell her if anyone tried to make him feel bad about his religion. He was 9. This past summer, Mamdani endured death threats, racist harassment, and accusations of anti-Semitism. "It takes a toll," he said, tearing up, at a press conference amid the controversy after the Bulwark podcast. "When I speak, especially when I speak with emotion, I am characterized by those same rivals as being a monster, as being at the gates, language that describes almost a barbarian looking to dismantle civilization." The same qualities that make Mamdani a generational figure have already made him a target. There's no if about it. As soon as Zohran puts his hand on the Quran and is sworn in as the first Muslim mayor of New York, Donald Trump will start firing away. Gaspard, formerly of the Center for American Progress, said, "Bernie Sanders, practically yelling into the phone, reminded me of the repression that has historically kept socialists at the margins of American politics. There was extraordinary opposition, illegal opposition," Sanders says. "You know that, right?" Mamdani spent the summer meeting with people who are trying to assess how much of a break from the past he'll actually be. Not every Wall Street suit who met Mamdani hated him. "He's not looking for a government takeover," one told me with measured optimism. "I don't think he's a socialist." City Hall veterans have emphasized that, apart from Trump's incursions, Mamdani's ability to govern will be defined by the people he surrounds himself with, and that he may have to choose between people who are experienced and people who share his political program. "His circle is small," a former deputy mayor told me. "He's going to have to take chances and be prepared to be wrong." Mamdani has said that, until the evening of the primary, he had doubts about whether he could win. He spent an hour and a half furiously writing a victory speech after Cuomo called him early that night to concede. Sitting with Mamdani in his living room as a single window darkened, I got the sense that the feeling of surprise had worn off. It was around 9 p.m. when he nudged me toward the door. "My brother," he said, slapping his hands on his knees and rising from the sofa. Mamdani's night wasn't over. There were more calls with aides, more interviews to prepare for. He took our dishes to the kitchen and started rinsing them in the sink. He was still wearing his tie. And now from the October 2025 issue, the real problem is how Trump can legally use the military. By Jeannie Suk Gerson. The militarization of American cities, including Los Angeles, Portland, and Chicago, has brought home a perverse irony. Throughout the history of the United States, immigrants have come here to escape authoritarian governments. But in the 21st century, it is Donald Trump's crackdowns on immigration and on the protests against them that are giving him momentum in the direction of ersatz dictatorship. The president has also threatened to deploy troops in more cities, such as San Francisco, Baltimore, and New York, against the will of the state's governors. At the nation's founding, James Madison warned that, quote, a standing military force with an overgrown executive will not long be safe companions to liberty, end quote, because of the temptation to turn soldiers into instruments of tyranny at home. The Constitution divides power over the military between the president, who is the commander-in-chief, and Congress, which funds and regulates the military, declares war, and provides for calling forth the militia to execute the laws of the Union, suppress insurrections, and repel invasions. In the Posse Comitatus Act of 1878, Congress spelled out that it is generally forbidden to use the military for civilian law enforcement. But in a statute from 1956, Congress gave the president the authority to federalize any state's National Guard in the event of an invasion by a foreign nation or rebellion against the federal government, or in cases when, quote, the president is unable with the regular forces to execute the laws of the United States, end quote. In June, President Trump first mobilized thousands of National Guard troops and hundreds of Marines to L.A. to protect ICE officers and other federal employees, functions, and property at sites where people were protesting against the administration. Those deployments provoked more protests, which in turn fueled the administration's claims that troops are needed to quell them. The sight of armed soldiers outfitted for war on city streets strikes many Americans as a frightening escalation from a president seemingly bent on punishing those who oppose him. The problem, though, is not what's illegal, but what is not illegal. The lawfulness of Trump's actions hinges on circumstances specified by Congress, and the courts have not been uniform in evaluating them. A federal district court in California temporarily blocked the deployment of troops to L.A. in June, but the Ninth Circuit lifted the block, recognizing that courts are highly deferential to a president's assessments. It found that Trump likely had a colorable basis for claiming to be unable with the regular forces to execute federal immigration law, given the evidence that some protesters had violently interfered with law enforcement by throwing things at ICE vehicles and federal officials, utilizing dumpsters as a battering ram at a federal building, lobbing Molotov cocktails, and vandalizing property. The California District Court later ruled that the administration had violated the Posse Comitatus Act by using soldiers to execute federal law, and an appeal is pending. Last week, an Oregon federal district judge, Karen Emmergut, who had been appointed by Trump, found that the president probably lacked the authority to federalize the National Guard to deploy in Portland in September. That conclusion rested largely on the contrast between Portland and L.A. in the weeks leading up to the president's orders regarding each city. That is, unlike when Trump sent troops to L.A., it had been months since there was any sustained level of violent or disruptive protest activity in Portland. The Justice Department's claims of disruptive protests in September, including setting up a makeshift guillotine, posting a photo of an ICE vehicle online, and shining flashlights in drivers' eyes, all of which, Judge Emmergut said, could be successfully handled by law enforcement. The president did not help his case by spreading outlandish falsehoods. He posted on Truth Social about war-ravaged Portland, ICE facilities under siege from attack by Antifa and other domestic terrorists, and chaos, death, and destruction. Even affording a great level of deference to the president, Judge Emmergut concluded that the claim that the Trump had been unable to execute federal law was simply untethered to the facts. But this common sense point about Trump's credibility may be controversial, too, because of the difficulty in determining when judicial second-guessing of the president's assessments amounts to usurping the power that Congress has delegated to him. The Ninth Circuit may well ignore Trump's posts and find that even low-level disruptions in recent weeks or violent incidents from months earlier are sufficient for him to send troops to protect federal officials' ability to do their jobs. Meanwhile, a district court temporarily enjoined the deployment of troops in Illinois, noting that the administration's perception of events is simply unreliable, which was a polite way of rejecting the warping of reality entailed in viewing the protests in Chicago as a rebellion. What is perhaps most concerning is that why judicial deference to a truth-indifferent president may mean that there is effectively little to no constraint on what he can do, which would quickly erase the separation of powers, not to mention the federalism, that the Constitution is supposed to ensure. The statute on federalizing the National Guard is only one of many laws that allow the president to decide whether certain circumstances exist, an invasion, rebellion, an emergency, an unusual and extraordinary threat, and so exercise an extraordinary power. Last week, Trump said that, if necessary, he would invoke another statute, the Insurrection Act, which creates an exception to the prohibition on using the military for law enforcement. The Insurrection Act, which Trump has frequently mentioned in the past, gives the president staggeringly broader power. For instance, it permits him to use military force inside the U.S. as he considers necessary to suppress any conspiracy that opposes or obstructs the execution of federal law. Judges and state officials must surely understand that, if they stymie Trump, he is poised to unleash a more dangerous and harder to check power that Congress has already handed him. Congress wrote such statutes with the apparent assumption that whoever held the office of the presidency would use the powers they granted in good faith. Courts, for their part, developed legal doctrines that require them to presume the president's good faith in deferring to him. The law may therefore be on the president's side, which is troubling for what it suggests about its capacity to protect against tyranny. Judge Emmergut insisted that this is a nation of constitutional law, not martial law. We must hope that they do not turn out to be one and the same. Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of the New Yorker magazine. I hope you enjoyed it, and we'll be sure and listen next time. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. The New Yorker readings are available as podcasts at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service today. This is Evan Mercer. So long, everybody.